Okay, you know, I asked that we, or my intent is for us to go quickly in these studies following and try to make up some time since we spent so much time on the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew chapters 5, 6, and 7. We're going to try to get back in the practice of one chapter a week, which takes a survey form, which means we go rapidly. We don't want to, again, rush through anything that you're not clear about. But as a result of the speed, we're going to have to cover the material quickly. If you have a handout to chapter 8, which we gave you last week, I just did want you to make note that the memory verse that is listed there, when Jesus told this scribe who had promised to follow him wherever he went, that foxes have holes, birds of the air have nests, but the Son of Man has nowhere to lay his head. That is chapter 8 and verse 20. I've got chapter 2, verse 2. That was simply because I was copy and pasting it and forgot to... I copied chapter 2 outline and dropped it in chapter 8 and redid it and forgot to make that change. So that's what that is. So it's chapter 8 and verse 20. Notice on that page that there are basically four major areas that we're going to be discussing in way of outline. Jesus' healing of a leper in verses 1 through 4. Then his traveling to Capernaum and the time that he spent beginning in verse 5 going through 22 in Capernaum. Then after leaving Capernaum, he was on the Sea of Galilee when the tempest arose and he was asleep in the boat. And at his disciples' request, he stilled the winds and the waves. And then finally, they got out of the boat on the eastern shore of the Sea of Galilee in the country of the Gergesenes, which probably is a mistranslation. So the King James sticks with it, New King James, of course, as well. But the more accurate would be the Gadarenes. And there are other references in the New Testament, and it's the same place. So probably the more correct is the country of the Gadarenes, and we'll talk a little bit about that when we get to chapter 8, 28 through 34. So looking at the outline, a couple of sites or locations of interest. First of all, the city of Capernaum or the village of Capernaum. Kind of interesting, when I was looking at the International Standard Bible Encyclopedia, which is an old work, they said, we really don't know where Capernaum is for sure. But when I went, they acted like that's where it was. And so it may have been that the ISBE was published before some new excavation was done. And we're going to talk a little bit about the city of Capernaum, specifically when we talk about the healing of the mother-in-law of Peter. But having said that, Capernaum is a village that is near the north shore of the Sea of Galilee. So just think of a map. Think of the River Jordan coming down, and then you got the Sea of Galilee, and then the river goes down, and then you got the Dead Sea. So the northeast part of the Sea of Galilee, which is not that big of a lake. It's also known as Lake Gennesaret. It's not a big body of water. So when you think of sea, really think of lake as far as size, because that's more properly, it's probably about the same size as Lake Worth. It's just not a big place at all. You can see across and see one shore from the other. And Capernaum was probably a half a mile, maybe a mile northeast of the shoreline. And that's where Capernaum was. I've got a quote from Leo Bowles in his commentary on this particular chapter concerning the place of Capernaum, because you'll notice in chapter 9, in verse 1, chapter 9 in verse 1, the statement, he got into a boat, crossed over, and came to his own city, that actually is the city of Capernaum. That's what's referenced there. And Leo Bowles says this, he said, Bethlehem bore him, Nazareth reared him, but Capernaum was his residence. And I think that's a pretty accurate statement concerning the time that he spent in his Galilean ministry. He spent a great deal of time. It was kind of a home base for him there in Capernaum. So it was a main center of his activity during that ministry in the northern regions of Israel. The only other thing I would note about Capernaum is the prophecy Jesus gave of it, because they did not heed him. In Matthew chapter 11, you may want to go just a few chapters over to Matthew chapter 11, verses 23 and 24, which came true when he said, you, Capernaum, who are exalted to heaven, will be brought down to Hades. For if the mighty works which were done in you had been done in Sodom, it would have remained until this day. But I say to you that it should be more tolerable for the land of Sodom in the day of judgment than for you. Of course, it had reference to the ungodliness, the pride that was present in the city at that time among those individuals, but also with regard to the destruction of the city, both Capernaum and Chorazin, which is also mentioned in that particular context. They are complete. There are no, and have not been, since their destruction, there have not been any lasting towns or settlements on either location. So now it's a tourist place. It's where you go if you want to look at. There are certain interesting places there, one of which very well may have been the house where Peter and Andrew lived in the village of Capernaum. And I'll talk a little bit about that in a few moments. We don't know that for sure, but that may be the case. Okay, second thing is the Sea of Galilee. And again, that's Lake Gennesaret. It's the lake that connects the Jordan from the headwaters to the Dead Sea. And it's big when it comes to the narrative. In other words, it is mentioned on any number of occasions. This was an area that Jesus was familiar with and where he spent much of his ministry as he was on earth. And then the country of the Gergesenes in chapter 8 and verse 28. And we'll talk about that in a few moments. The Gadarenes is located on the east side of the Sea of Galilee. And in that region or that area, the major or chief city was Gadara, which is where it got the name Gadarenes. And that was actually a couple of miles away from the shore. But the country of the Gergesenes or the Gadarenes, it's obvious from a number of reasons. One would be this particular narrative that the land that was considered theirs extended to the shore because it was there that the demons were cast out into the swine and they went violently down the steep place into the sea. And by the way, you can go there and you look and say, okay, and there's really only one location presently that seems to fit that. So there may be some certainty as to where actually this particular miracle happened when those demons were cast out. The other thing that's interesting is that in the seal that was used with regard to official documents, there was a ship, which is an indication, again, that that area or that region was something that reached all the way to the shores of the lake. Okay, so those are the three places that are listed in this. Now, the other thing is the people that we kind of go through quickly. And there are a lot of people that are mentioned here, but only two that I think of any great significance. We're going to talk about the centurion in Capernaum, whose servant was healed. We'll talk about him a little bit. A centurion was the leader of 100 men. It was a position of very a great import in the Roman army. And he was a commander of 100 men in the Roman army, and he was an important man. In the account in Luke, we are told that he loved the people. He loved the people of Capernaum. He loved the Jews. And he built them a synagogue. And so he was an individual of some importance, and he was someone who was friendly to the Jews and to their religion. And so it's not surprising that he would have this response to Jesus that we'll see as we get into this. But his humility and his faith both stand out, and we want to talk about that when we get an opportunity in a few moments. And then the other one is Peter's mother-in-law. There's no significance to this woman except for the fact that she existed, which indicates that Peter was married. And because of that, there are a couple of things that we can learn from that. First of all, the Catholic Church denies that Peter was married. The idea of the papacy is a celibate position. And the fact that was, I don't know if they deny it, but the fact is that the concept of papal celibacy and the celibacy of the priesthood is something that would fly in the face of the fact that Peter had a mother-in-law. Also, in 1 Peter 5:1, you'll remember we studied 1 Peter just recently. In chapter 5 and verse 1, the apostle Peter referred to himself as a fellow elder. And since we're talking about the qualifications of the eldership to be a husband of one wife, he certainly wouldn't be excluded from literally being an elder in a local congregation based upon the lack of qualifications. He didn't have a wife. Maybe intimate even that he had children, although we have no indication of children in Scripture. That doesn't mean he didn't have them. We just don't know about it. And then the third thing is a reference the Apostle Paul made in 1 Corinthians 9. If you'll turn there very quickly. 1 Corinthians 9 in verses 3 through 6. The Apostle Paul was being criticized for being supported in the work that he did. Remember, he made tents. There were a number of times when he did not take support from local churches because he didn't want to be accused of doing it for money. But he defended himself in 1 Corinthians 9 and verse 3. And he said, "My defense to those who examine me is this. Do we have no right to eat and drink? Do we have no right to take along a believing wife, as do also the other apostles, the brothers of the Lord, and Cephas?" Cephas, of course, is another name for Peter. So there is a specific reference to Peter having a wife, again, and that as a preacher, there is the right, or an apostle, but a preacher, one who is working in the Word, the right to receive support in the work done so that they can support both themselves as well as their family. And there is an indication of the right of that. And so he said, "Or is it only Barnabas and I who have no right to refrain from working?" They worked hard, but he's talking about secular employment, making tents instead of working in the Word. Okay, so with regard to the people and places, any questions at all? All right, the rest of this is the events. And there are a couple of teaching opportunities in the midst of these events. But the events, really, you'll notice I say no events, it's the miracles, because all of the events were miracles. That's what this is. It's a schedule of or a narration of various miracles that Jesus performed throughout the entirety of that chapter. And so we're just going to kind of skip down to that section of miracles. So I would like someone, if you will, to read for me chapter 8 and verses, let's see here, verses 1 through 4, the healing of the leper. You want to do that for me? Yes, Jim, please.
"When he had come down from the mountain, great multitude followed him. And behold, a leper came and worshipped him, saying, 'Lord, if you are willing, you can make me clean.' Then Jesus put out his hand and touched him, saying, 'I am willing, be cleansed.' Immediately his leprosy was cleansed. And Jesus said to him, 'See that you tell no one, but go your way, show yourself to the priest, and offer the gift that Moses commanded as a testimony to them.'"
Okay. Two things to note. First of all, the scourge of leprosy itself, just to note very quickly. I think that it was a very a horrific thing. It was something that was too common at that time. And of course, there is much that is said in the Old Testament about it, to which Jesus makes reference in that statement in verse 4, where he told them, "Go your way and show yourself to the priest." Interestingly, leprosy is not overly contagious. It is something that you can get from someone else, but it's not so contagious to where there's a... it's not considered one of the most contagious diseases that exists. But just think about it. There was no cure. And think about what happened with regard to leprosy, that basically... your skin would slough off, fingers would fall off. It was just a horrific thing. And so it was something that really scared the people of that time, certainly. And there were laws that were placed about it as to how it should be dealt with. If there was a spot that might be considered leprous, an individual was to separate himself from the camp. And they actually had colonies. I mean, even that's happened until the 19th. Maybe even early 20th century, where you have leper colonies where people would go and get away from other people so that other people wouldn't get this disease. But there were things that needed to be done. Leviticus chapter 14, in verses 2 and 3, the law of the leper for the day of his cleansing. You're unclean, but now, hey, it's gone away. Maybe it wasn't leprosy after all, or maybe... I don't know enough about it. I didn't study it enough. It may be that the body's immune system could possibly beat it if it weren't a bad case. And so this is what happens. He shall be brought to the priest. That's what Jesus referred to. And the priest shall go out of the camp, and the priest shall examine him. So he's going to be brought to the priest, but not in the camp. The priest goes out to meet him. And the priest will examine him, and if the leprosy is healed in the leper, then there would be various sacrifices that would be offered depending upon how much, how affluent the family was or the man was. So that's the way it would be handled. And that's what Jesus was referring to. The leprosy was cleansed, no doubt about it, but he still had that ritual requirement in order to obey the law of the land to be examined by the priest to make sure that he actually was healed. The thing that is more interesting to me is Jesus' statement to go tell no one. Anybody have any ideas as to why Jesus would tell the leper not to tell anybody what had happened? Because, by the way, the leper didn't do what he said. He wouldn't tell people. But why would Jesus say that? My question.
So he wasn't mocked by people coming to be healed.
Okay. Yeah, the healings were being done, so it's not like it wasn't time yet for the healings to start or for the miracles to start. You'll remember in the wedding feast at Cana, when his mom told him, do something, he kind of said, "You're jumping the gun a little bit," but did because she compelled him to. But that wasn't the case here. But there were logistical problems that came as a result of these miracles being performed, where people, looky-loos, people who, you see an accident on the freeway, and what do? Everybody slows down and looks. You hear about some amazing thing happening. His purpose was to teach. It wasn't to heal. He healed, and he had compassion. We'll talk about that a little bit tonight. But the idea that it could be taken over in that regard is not something he desired. You'll remember the number of occasions where he went to be by himself. And in fact, in the text in Luke chapter 5, which is Luke's telling of this same event, in his record of the event in verses 15 and 16, Luke 5, 15 and 16, Luke wrote that the report went around concerning him all the more, and great multitudes came together to hear and to be healed by him of their infirmities. So they came specifically to get healed, just like the leper had been healed. And so we're told in verse 16 that he himself often withdrew into the wilderness and prayed. And so I think the more probable explanation is the one that Debbie supplied, in that it impacted basically the logistics of his going and doing what he desired to go and to do in his ministry. And so he desired that it not be known. There were going to be plenty that would be known. There wasn't a need for this man to sound it out. But I can understand, even though he disobeyed Jesus' desire, I can understand him wanting to let people know. And people would have found out anyway to a certain extent, because if they were aware he had leprosy and all of a sudden he doesn't, that something had happened. So that's the basic reason that I would give as well. Anybody want to add anything to that particular miracle? Yes.
Two interesting things is the face of the leper. Because we're going to compare that with the centurions when we get over there, what Jesus says about him. But this leper, with the stigma surrounding him, the multitudes probably parted like the sea when he came walking through. So he had to overcome that stigma to get close enough to Jesus to speak to him. So his faith was great, his desire was very great to be healed, and so he did that. The second thing is that Jesus touched him. That would have been something that would have been noticed by those who were in the immediate surroundings. I don't see Jesus touching him on his clothing. I think he touched him on his face.
Or face, yeah.
Yeah, right. The most hideous part of him, because that would have been something phenomenal for him to have done. And people started seeing him do that, see, would have made a big impression on him.
The miracles of Jesus were evident,
yes,
always, and that's something that's obvious. And the other thing to add to this, because we are going to talk a little bit about the faith as we have time, but the... you'll notice the statement they made, "If you're willing, you can make me clean." A lot of times people will say, you'll even have, quote, faith healers today that will say, well, we couldn't do it because their faith was not strong enough. Understand that Jesus had the ability, and there were occasions when the miracles were performed even with an individual who is either unaware or didn't have faith or whatever the case may be. And so this power that Jesus had was not conditioned upon an individual believing. That power was innate in Jesus as the Son of God. He healed whomever he wishes. But he did use it often, these healings, as an opportunity to talk about faith and to test the faith of individuals. And this individual certainly did have a great deal of faith. Okay, someone read to me verses 5 through 13 with regard to the cleansing or the healing of the servant of the centurion. Dennis, would you mind doing that for me?
Sure. Now, when Jesus had entered Capernaum, a centurion came to him pleading with him, saying, "Lord, my servant is lying at home paralyzed, dreadfully tormented." And Jesus said to him, "I will come and heal him." The centurion answered and said, "Lord, I am not worthy that you should come under my roof, but only speak a word, and my servant will be healed. For I am also am a man under authority, having soldiers under me. And I say to this one, go, and he goes, and to another, come, and he comes, and to my servant, do this, and he does it. When Jesus heard it, he marveled and said to those who followed, assuredly, I say to you, I have not seen such great faith, not even in Israel. And I say to you that many will come from east and west and sit down with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob in the kingdom of heaven. But the sons of the kingdom will be cast out into outer darkness. There will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. Then Jesus said to the centurion, go your way, and as you have believed, so let it be done for you. And his servant was healed that same hour.
A couple of things. First of all, note in verse 8 and verse 10 that the two characteristics that really stand out was the humility of this man, an important man who had the rule over 100 men and 100 Roman soldiers, and also his great faith, as was declared by Jesus in verse 10 of the text. Kind of an interesting thing that while there are, you know, with regard to religious leaders and politicians and such, there's not much good that is said about them as a group in anywhere in the New Testament. However, every single time in the New Testament that you read about a centurion, it's in a positive light. And it's somewhat coincidence. I'm not saying that they're not corrupt individuals who served in those capacities, but perhaps there's something to be said about the integrity of a military man, an individual who takes his charge seriously. You have, for example, the centurion who declared truly this was the Son of God, the cross of Jesus in Mark chapter 15. Cornelius was a centurion in Acts chapter 10. He was a devout man who prayed to God fervently. And then even the individual who came to arrest Paul, the centurion who was in charge of his arrest in Acts chapter 22, and then later in chapter 27, was a man who showed kindness to Paul, and just was basically doing his duty, but was not overtly mean or cruel to Paul in that situation. So maybe there's something to be said with regard to the character of these particular men. Again, there is an account in Luke chapter 7 that seems to be a parallel account, although there are some things that we would have to basically resolve. In Luke chapter 7 and verse 5, I mentioned to you before, this was where we are told that the elders of the Jews had come to Jesus making a petition on his behalf, saying that he was a friend of the people, that he loved the people, loved the nation, and that he had built them a synagogue. And so this was a man that was well respected by the Jews. I want you to notice in Luke chapter 7 that the request that the centurion made was through their agency. Some might say that's a contradiction, because in Matthew chapter 8 it seems that he's there face to face. And some have even went so far as saying maybe it's two different healings, and there's a third one, and I forget now exactly the details of that third one, that there are, but it was in Cana, right after the wedding feast of Cana, John chapter 4 or 5. And which had obviously put it in the wrong place, so it couldn't have been that. So there is a way to alleviate this perceived discrepancy and to indicate that the centurion knew of Jesus, desired for Jesus to heal him, and made his petition through the agency of another. In other words, others petitioned on his behalf, in his name, or for the purpose of having Jesus help them. Either that, or it's possible that it's two different occasions. But it just seems like the details in Luke chapter 7 and Matthew 8 are sufficiently close where that's probably what happened. But I think that the significant thing to be found in this particular text is his humility. Well, what he said as a man of importance in verse 8, a wealthy man, as well as a powerful man, Lord, I'm not worthy that you should come under my roof. His recognition of authority. The fact that if Jesus was who Jesus claimed to be, and he believed him to be that, it wasn't necessary that he come. All he had to do is say the word. And I think that's interesting because of how many times Jesus did in his words as the Creator. In the beginning was the Word, was with God, Word was God. Same in the beginning with God, all things were made by him. God said, let there be light, and there was light. Even later on in our particular account with regard to the time that was on the Sea of Galilee where he said, "Peace, be still," and the winds and the waves ceased, shows the power of Jesus. Well, this is something that this individual understood. So he understood it because he himself was a man of authority, but he also, that indicates how great a faith he had in Jesus. And it was a faith that even the disciples later on did not match. You'll notice in chapter 8 and verse 26, as they were on that boat, and they said to the Lord, "Save us, we are perishing." His answer in verse 26 of chapter 8, "Why are you fearful, O you of little faith? Why are you afraid?" Because their fear, though it was again understandable, waves coming in, boisterous, it was a difficult situation. Fact is, the Lord was with them. And if the centurion had been there, he would have said, nothing to worry about, Jesus is here. But they lacked that faith that this centurion had, the degree of faith. And so it is certainly for us to note, and perhaps would be helpful to us to remember when we somewhat are sometimes guilty perhaps of not having sufficient faith when we pray to God and ask God for what we need, is that, you know, we don't waver, don't doubt. A double-minded man and stable in all his ways, you can't expect to receive anything from the Lord, but the faith like this is one that's going to be rewarded, and it's certainly a commendable thing. So I did want to note his humility as well as his faith as two things of importance in this particular section. Alright? Now, with regard to that, one of the teachings of Jesus that's found there is that dissertation on faith, and what I wanted to point out is that distinction. But I also wanted to note in chapter 8 and verse 10, he says, "I haven't found this faith in Israel." And he says, "Many will come from east and west," having reference to those outside of Israel, "and they will sit down with Abraham, and they will sit down in Isaac and Jacob in the kingdom of heaven, but the sons of the kingdom will be cast out into darkness." So that referenced, of course, the fact that the Jews were the sons of the kingdom. They were the ones that were looking forward to it and be given the promise of the kingdom of Israel. And yet they would be without. Why? Lack of faith. Lack of faith. That's the key. And so there's a good lesson for us there as well. Okay. Any more questions, comments about that section? It is quick, isn't it?
You talked about the authority that the Jews had. That then apply to us too, that we can learn from the authority as he commanded his people. The same thing with our Savior, our King commands, we need to do his bidding without question.
Without question. Good point.
And we can learn also.
Good deal. Debbie, would you read verses 14 through 17 for me? Matthew 8, 14 through 17.
"Now when Jesus had come into Peter's house, he saw his wife's mother lying sick with a fever. So he touched her hand, and the fever left her, and she arose and served them. When evening had come, they brought to him many who were demon-possessed, and he cast out the spirits with the word and healed all who were sick, that it might be fulfilled which was spoken by Isaiah the prophet, saying, 'He himself took our infirmities and bore our sicknesses.'"
So you'll notice there is the mention of the healing of many, and also in verse 16 we're told that many who were demon possessed were brought to him, the demons were cast out. And of course, as we get down to the end of the chapter in verses 28 through 34, we have the demons there being cast out. So I do want to spend just a few moments talking about demon possession, because there's a discussion question that I have on the page, and that is, does demon possession continue to this day? Because there are a lot of people who claim that it does. Well, a couple of things to note. First of all, demon possession in the first century was obvious. A lot of times when you have charismatics that will talk about demon possession, they'll talk about the demon of anxiety, the demon of fear, the demon of selfishness, and what they're doing is turning temptations and character faults into demons. The Catholic Church, of course, has practiced exorcisms in the past, but typically that was during a time of great superstition, and the Catholic Church, to a very great extent, has actually backed off of that, and they don't like to even talk about it, though it had been a practice that was fairly common with regard to demon exorcism. So I want to make a couple of points. First of all, some logic to be applied here. We've talked a lot about the fact that the age of miracles has come to an end. We've talked about the purpose of those miracles. Why was Jesus doing the miracles? Why was he casting out demons in this first century? It was to confirm his authority and who he was. And what he taught was from God. Now, 1 Corinthians 13 indicates, and I think we can look at a number of other arguments that we're not going to go into today, to emphasize the fact that miracles no longer occur today because the need for those miracles has passed. We don't need them anymore because the word has been confirmed, Jesus has been proven as the Messiah, and so that time for miracles have ceased. So logically, since demon possession, in order for there to be the exorcising of the demon, there has to be a miracle performed. That's what Jesus was doing. That if those miracles are no longer performed, then God would not allow that power to exist. Because in this particular context, as you'll notice, especially in verse 29, going down to the example in the Gergesene, they cried out saying, "What have we to do with you, Jesus, you Son of God? Have you come here to torment us before the time?" And they begged him, "If you cast us out, permit us to go away into the herd of swine." And so Jesus had this power to bind them. That power to limit those demons is something that existed and has always existed. It's a part of God's sovereignty and his omnipotence. And so when we do not see the evidence of demon possession as it so obviously was in the first century, we recognize that we no longer have the means of casting them out. And logically, there is that that conclusion that we can make is that the demon possession doesn't exist today, not like it did in the first century. But there's another argument that I want to make. I want you to look at going down to the example of the Gergesenes. I know we're going a little bit out of order in this regard. But I want you to notice what they said to him in verse 29. So we'll start with verse 28. He had come to the other side of the country of the Gergesenes, and there met him two demon-possessed men coming out of the tombs, exceedingly fierce, so that no one could pass that way. And suddenly they cried out, saying, "What have we to do with you, Jesus, you Son of God? Have you come here to torment us before the time?" Torment us before the time. The question is, what's the time? And there are two possibilities with regard to before the time. But I do want you to notice, an argument has been made that one of... Let me go find the passage. One of the possibilities is a reference to a prophecy that Zechariah gave in Zechariah 13. So I'd like you to turn with me there to Zechariah chapter 13. Because it seems at this particular time that Zechariah was actually prophesying about a time when idolatry would cease to be pervasive, and that the unclean spirits or demons would no longer be active. There's an actually prophecy about that. So in chapter 13, in verse 1 and 2, it says, "In that day, a fountain shall be opened for the house of David and for the inhabitants of Jerusalem, for sin and for uncleanness. It shall be in that day, says the Lord of hosts, that I will cut off the names of the idols from the land, and they shall no longer be remembered. And I will also cause the prophets and the unclean spirit to depart from the land." The question could be with regard to that, is this an indication of that time when those kinds of miracles and what was demonstrated at this time would come to an end? And that might be the reference. The other possibility, which is the one that is more commonly given, is that it is a reference to the final judgment. And of course, in Jude 6, you'll remember that the demons are those referred to as angels that did not keep their proper abode, but left their own abode, that God had reserved for them the chains of darkness in the judgment of the great day. And so there would be finally that. So it may be that they had reference there to that end. So again, they're, you know, someone says, well, you know, demon possession. There is nothing that explicitly states the demon possession has come to an end, other than possibly that reference in Zechariah and the logic that I expressed to you. But it doesn't seem to be that there are demon possessions today. A lot of things we don't understand that go on, but as far as demon possession. I've had Christians come to me that say, I see auras. Other Christians who've come to me and said, I see ghosts. And they are actually 100% sure of the fact. You know, you've heard of Christians who said, you know, I woke up suddenly with this feeling of dread one night and got a call half hour later and someone, you know, had died the exact time I woke up, you know, that kind of thing. You hear those, I don't know what that means at all. I'm just saying that the power that the demons had in the first century, they do not seem to have anymore. And it makes sense that they wouldn't. Okay? Yes, please.
Apparently, since that time, of course, we have no received revelation. So it's argument to say whether we still have it or not. Well, we certainly had it before. There was 39 books written before Jesus even walked the earth, right?
That's referenced.
There's not the demon possession anywhere in the Old Testament that you see during that first century. Specifically during Jesus' ministry and the early church. And I think the argument, like you said, can be made that the whole purpose for that, God allowed it then and only then, was so that he could show his power over them. Otherwise, if they continue to exist, there's no real reason for it, and it would seem to say that God doesn't have power over those demons. Else, why would they continue? Well, of course, he does. Satan had to have permission from God just to touch Job. That demonstrates the power that he has and exercises over not just the demons, but Satan and all of them.
Yeah.
So he only allowed it for a very specific and a short time, and for a specific purpose. After that purpose was fulfilled, not anymore.
And to think otherwise is to take the common view of that day, or one other possibility is, as far as expressed, is that it was just a time of superstition. And I don't think that that's a legitimate thing, in the sense of that they were any more superstitious in the first century than they were in centuries previous at all. I mean, every group, generation thinks they're more sophisticated and less superstitious than one preceding anyway, but there's no indication that they were more superstitious than those before. But secondly, because the Holy Spirit is informing us that these were actual demons. So we do know that they were present there in the first century, but there's no indication of it before that or after. Okay, so let's do make a note of one other thing, actually two other things. We want to emphasize with regard to his ability to still the winds and the sea that's found in verses 23 through 27, two things: his power over the elements, which we've already discussed in some detail, and also the lack of faith and the fact that they feared. Again, don't be too harsh on these men, these disciples of our Lord. You would have been afraid too if you were in that boat, most probably, because it can really get stormy and they were fishermen. They knew people died out on that boat. By the way, it's kind of a funnel situation. So the wind comes, it comes howling. The waves get. It's about 25. A typical boat. They've actually uncovered one. I got to see it while I was over in Israel. About 25 feet long. 7.5 feet wide at its widest, you know, going shaped like a canoe, but 5.5 feet and about 4 feet deep. And it's not a very big boat. Maybe 20 people, if it was filled to the max, could fit in it. And so it wasn't a big sailing ship. It was a big canoe is what it was out in the middle of that sea. So the fear was understandable, and yet he admonished them because the fear indicated a lack of faith on their part in his ability to care for them and to protect them. And that's something that we would do well to understand and to learn from as well. Okay, so the only other thing that I wanted to note in this particular chapter is found in verses 18 through 22. And that is the cost of discipleship. Jesus saw great multitudes about him. He gave a command to depart to the other side. And a certain scribe said, I'll follow you wherever you go. He said, foxes have holes, birds of the air have nests, but the Son of Man has nowhere to lay his head. Another of his disciples said to him, Lord, let me first go and bury my father. And Jesus said to him, follow me and let the dead bury their own dead. So there is a cost that is associated to, you know, you may suffer privation, you may have to leave family in order to serve him acceptably. There is one thing to note with regard to that phrase, let the dead bury their own dead. There are a number of interpretations, but I was reading, Curtis Pope in his commentary in Truth Magazine, Truth Series, and he said, keep in mind something, is that a burial when a Jew died, there was a burial where they would be put in the tomb. They weren't buried underground. They were put in the tomb. So here's a shelf in the tomb, and it was closed up. And then they would go back a year later, and they would take the bones after the decay process had finished, and they would put them in a bone box, which was a second burial. And he postulates that that was what was being said. And now there's some who will take the view that let the spiritually dead bury the dead, and you go and come and follow me. But think about this, man says, you know, his father had died. I got a year, and I'll come follow you. And his basic statement was, he's with the dead. He doesn't need you to bury him again, you know, because the dead are there. They can minister to him. In other words, he has no more need from any living being. You need to recognize what's more important and come follow me. I thought that was an interesting explanation of that text that might very well be legitimate. Because I've actually gone, while I was over there, I've seen the bone boxes, and that's typical. You know, there's not a lot of space, not a lot of room, a lot of people, you know. So what they would do is, after that year, then they would gather the bones and put them in a box about this big, you know. And they were, you go across the Valley of Hinnom from the city and up where the Garden of Gethsemane is, on that hill, Mount of Olives, and there's a large Jewish graveyard. And it's just a gigantic place full of ossuaries, bone boxes. That's the final resting place of all those. And very interesting.
It's also a possibility his father actually hadn't died yet.
Yeah.
He's about to die or would be soon. But the thing is, the Jews buried that day. The day you died was the day you were buried. So that really wouldn't have cost him any time. So that would have been what he was talking about.
I do like Pope's explanation of that. I think that's a very obvious one. Obvious could be something. Thank you. We got through it. Chapter 9 next week.